I'm so you mean, mean pride.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky back in studio. Thanks so much to Matt Arnold, who is still sitting here with me for covering the first half an hour. No one I would rather have talk about what's going on with the Wisconsin State Supreme Court.
Ross, thanks again. Appreciate it. Thanks for letting me hang out
for a little longer. Our state's very own expert on all issues related to state Supreme Courts everywhere.
You know, all one of us.
Before we continue on that, a couple things I want to mention. Coming up at the next break, we are going to be joined by Del Wilber, who is the author of a book called Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. We're going to talk with him about his book, about what he learned about Ronald Reagan. He's got an event coming up on Thursday at the Denver Press Club, a lunch at noon. If you go to denverpressclub.org and find their events page and find this coming Thursday, the 14th, nice. You can meet Del Wilber and have him sign your book and have a chat with him. And we will talk with him here on the show in just a few minutes. Also, coming up an hour from now, starting at 6:30, we're going to have in studio Dr. Kevin Lutz, who is a general practitioner here in Denver, whose business model is what's called concierge medicine, which I find to be a fascinating business model and one which I think is going to grow rapidly in America as the government tries to push us towards socialized medicine. And we'll let Dr. Lutz explain it in more detail. But the short version is you pay the doctor an annual fee, one fee, and you have essentially unlimited access to the doctor over the course of the year. And a lot of people are doing that. They love the personal connection with the doctor. They love that they can essentially always get an appointment the same day or the next day. And I think it's a great business. And so we're going to talk to Dr. Lutz about that. And then in the 7 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to Paul Moreno, who is a professor of history with a particular focus on constitutional history from Hillsdale College. And he's also the dean of faculty of Hillsdale College. He's been doing a lot of interesting research lately, including on how congressional regulation of issues that seemed relatively uncontroversial at the time, you know, things that the public wanted regulated, but which Congress didn't have the constitutional authority to regulate, how that has turned into a big problem, and how this abandoning the Constitution, which is an issue that you, Matt, focus on more than most people, how that's turned into a huge problem. So let's turn back to this Wisconsin thing for a minute, Matt. What I want to ask you, in a real nuts and bolts politics kind of way, what do you think is the psychological impact? You know, I used this analogy as I was thinking about it myself. Let's say, you know, you're playing in a really important football game. You're an athlete. You're in the Super Bowl or some very big game. And the clock ticks down to zero, and you're up by 2 points, and you think you've won the game, and the referee comes out and says, no, the clock should have stopped with 2 seconds left. The clock kept running when it shouldn't have, put 2 seconds back on the clock. It gives the other team one last play, and with it, they kick a 55-yard field goal and win the game and win the Super Bowl. So, to me, the emotional impact of that on the losing team is a whole different thing than if they were down all game and lost 37-14 and never really had a chance. And what's your take on the political, emotional impact, if it holds up the way it looks like right now, on the public sector union movement?
Well, I think in general, the emotional impact, you know, like you pointed out there, it's a lot harder to lose when you don't feel like it's the other team that beat you. It's the referees that basically handed it to them. And, you know, I think that's true across the board. It's definitely true in sports, and it's certainly true in the legislature and you know, in politics. And I think that we've been seeing that happen a number of times. So, you know, clearly the impact, the emotional impact is very large. Now, I think what happened here is kind of a little bit different than the analogy you painted, because in this case, it looked to me more like the unions in Wisconsin were trying to replace the ref with their own guy or gal in this case to ensure that they would have that clock stopped the way they wanted it to. I mean, they made no bones about it. Kloppenburg, the challenger, made no bones about the fact that she intended to use her power on the court to overturn the legislation that had just been passed in Wisconsin.
When did you hear her say that? Because I never heard that.
It was actually one of the things, and actually one of the things I wrote in my post today. There was a I'd have to look it up, but and let me look through here while I find that. But basically made it very clear that she was in fact, you know, had a position, wink wink, nudge nudge, that I will be a check on the legislative and executive branches. And the unions also very clearly understood that to be the case, with the almost $5 million they poured into her race, very clearly putting their money where their mouth was, understanding they lost in the legislature, they lost the governor's race. So the only way to cling to power, the only way to continue their hold on things in Wisconsin was to take that Supreme Court seat, put their own referee in charge, and change the rules of the game.
You know, I was doing a little research on Kloppenburg and Mr. Kloppenburg. I found that basically all of their federal donations that were reported at the FEC level were to Russ Feingold, bundled through a group called Progressives United. And Mrs. Kloppenburg's husband, whose name is Jack, who is, I think, a sociology professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison, was a signer of an open letter to Governor Walker and legislators blasting their changes to union rules. So Kloppenburg and her husband are far left progressives, and I had, you know, she was saying, well, you know, I'm going to be impartial, and I'm going to follow the law, and I don't believe it for a second. I mean, if she had won this race, she would have known who bought the race for her,
well,
and she would have paid him back. Even if it was only paying him back with one ruling and then being impartial the rest of the time after that, she would have paid him back with that one ruling.
Right, and it would have gone far beyond that because, you know, as you know, once you're owned by someone, you're owned by someone, and they would have come back time and again, and Kloppenburg would have delivered time and again. And I think that's a real danger. And you know, that's one of the arguments people have advanced for not having contested elections for the courts. I think there is some merit to that argument. The flip side of that, though, is if you don't have any means to hold judges accountable when they color outside the lines, as we've seen in Colorado, then you have an equally dangerous situation where judges sort of set themselves up as rulers, as the final word on everything, and don't feel beholden to the law, certainly don't feel beholden to the people, and basically set themselves up as little mini kings. And it's interesting how far back this goes. I was doing a little bit of research on this and found this exact discussion took place in the Anti-Federalist Papers back at the time of the founding of our Constitution. The danger of judicial despotism was well understood and pointed out 200 years ago, that without any kind of control on the courts, that they could, in fact, become the most dangerous branch of government. And I think we've seen that slowly over time, and really has accelerated over the last several years since the progressive movement really took off, and really has accelerated. But this has been a problem that's been creeping up through our system of government almost from the very start.
Yeah, did you have a chance to see Kloppenburg's press briefing just after it appeared that she won? Did you see that?
I saw something. I'm not sure I saw the same clip that you saw, but basically, you know, very arrogantly declaring victory on the basis of 204 votes.
Exactly.
With the count still going on.
Right. And the reporter asked her, why are you so confident, you know, with such a slim margin of victory? And the reporter said, that number could easily be just a counting error in one county.
Right.
And she said, you know, the we had deep and broad support, and I'm gratified in our victory, and I'm confident this result will stand. Just the fact that she said that, she just says a lot about her,
right?
I think. And, you know, Wisconsin's much better off without her, but I wonder at what point rank-and-file union members will get tired, or if they're even paying enough attention, we'll get tired of their money being wasted on these kinds of elections. You may recall down in Arkansas, in this previous election cycle, the Democrats, the far left, and the unions spent $10 million in a primary challenge to Blanche Lincoln.
Right.
Because Blanche Lincoln came out against card check. And they spent $10 million backing this guy whose name, I forget, begins with an H, Halder maybe. And they lost, And I just wonder at what point the average, you know, the average person who's in the union is going to say, stop spending my money like that. On the other hand, at this point, we're talking about public sector unions.
Right.
And
well, and they do get a payoff for it. And certainly the union bosses understand very well it's really an effective use of the tactic for them because it enables them to control one more branch of government.
It is. And the union bosses, we always have to keep in mind, they don't necessarily have the best interests of even their own union members in mind. They certainly don't have the best interest of the nation in mind, especially when it comes to public sector unions, because all of their money comes from taxpayers. I mean, they're you know,
at some point you kill the goose that lays the golden egg, right?
You know, they're basically parasites. And yes, there are legitimate functions of government, and there do need to be government employees doing those legitimate functions of government. Government does way too much, and that's a discussion for another day. But there's nothing about the fact that we need government employees that says they must have collective bargaining rights that lets them bankrupt the rest of us.
No, and even FDR, who's certainly no opponent of the unions, was adamant about saying under no circumstances should public sector employees be allowed to unionize. That is a direct contradiction in the interest, because with whom are they bargaining? Themselves,
right,
essentially, and the people they buy.
That's exactly right. When we come back after this break, we're going to be joined by Del Wilber, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. As I said, he's having a Denver Press Club event at noon on April 14th, and you do need to RSVP if you want to go to that. So go to denverpressclub.org events. You can find it. Stay with us right here through these words on Backbone Radio. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Backbone Radio.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio. I'm your host, Ross Kaminsky. We are pleased and privileged to be joined on the VIP line by Washington Post reporter and now best-selling author Del Wilber, whose book, Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan, is, I think, number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list right now. Welcome to the show, Delber.
Hey, no,
Del. Sorry about that. I put your first and last name together. Welcome to the show. And, tell us a little bit about how you got involved writing this book. I know you weren't, just sitting around researching 30-year-old history as you were a reporter for the Washington Post.
No, in fact, I was 6 years old when this happened, and I was covering the federal courts of the Washington Post, and, John Hinckley's the one who shot Ronald Reagan. He's a, Denver, Evergreen, Colorado guy back in 1981, and he was found not guilty by reason of insanity in the shooting. And he's been held at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in the district ever since. But over the years, he petitions the court, his doctors petition the court, his, psychiatrist, his lawyers petition the court to give him more freedom, and now he has like 9-10-day unaccompanied visits to his mother's house in Virginia. And I'm covering one of these hearings where he asked for more privilege, and this one he's asking to get a driver's license. And I just find it bizarre, sitting 15 feet from a guy who shot the President of the United States, the most revered Republican since Teddy Roosevelt, and you're looking at him, and he has this, it's like no emotion on his face. It's so strange. Like, they're talking about a sex life, and his face is so flat. And I cover this hearing and move on. And a few days later, this FBI agent calls me over to his office, and they're really upset that I've heard about an undercover investigation involving Ethiopian taxicab drivers bribing D.C. officials. If you know anything about D.C. government, there is some corruption. And so these guys are bribing them, and they didn't want me to break the, break a story on it and wreck their case. They'd spent 2 years on or something like that, and they're talking to me, and this agent gets up from this conference table and goes over to his desk, rummages through the drawer, and he comes back and slaps something heavy in my hand. I look down. It's a gun. I went, oh, my God, what? And I was like, now I'm really, it's like, we really don't want you to do it. We're giving you a gun. And the agent goes, that's John Hinckley's gun. I went, what's it doing in your desk drawer? Shouldn't it be in a museum or something? And they, after that, I got curious about how this day has been treated by history. And I, went to the library, couldn't find any books on it. And pretty soon I was interviewing, Jerry Parr, the lead agent. If you've seen the video or the pictures of the assassination attempt, he's the guy in the trench coat who shoves Reagan in the limousine that day outside the Washington Hilton 30 years ago. And I just interviewed Jerry Parr, and I didn't actually think I'd get anywhere with him because, you know, there's the Secret Service for a reason, the secret, you know, but he talked. And then pretty soon everyone was talking, and after 125 interviews, I pieced together the idea that, you know, this day was one of the most traumatic days in U.S. presidential history. Ronald Reagan came so close to death, something that people really don't understand today, and it recalibrated his entire presidency. I didn't realize, for example, that this is the 70th day of his first term, that on the 65th day of his first term, he had the lowest approval rating of any president at that time period in their first term. No idea. And so, you know, I got into it that way, and that's what led me to write the book.
So tell us a little more. I mean, you said most people don't know how close he came to dying. I mean, tell us a little bit about the time from, you know, from the shots to the hospital.
Yeah, you know, well, Ronald Reagan, who, you know, I really came to admire in reporting this in this book, and, you know, he was giving a speech at the Washington Hilton Hotel, and if you've ever seen it, this majestic hotel in Northwest Washington where, you know, they have this huge international ballroom. That's where presidents always go to talk. I mean, they're always going there. In fact, the 10 years before March 30th, 1981, presidents had made 110 visits to that hotel. They're always there. So Reagan goes there to deliver a speech to the AFL-CIO, you know, Building and Constructions Trades Department of that union, and he even rewrote that speech by hand. I mean, it was such a rush being a researcher to find that rewrite, handwritten rewrite. And then the more research it did in Reagan was, this is not unusual. Up to this point in his presidency, in his previous life, he wrote and rewrote all of his speeches and all of his correspondence. He had a strongly formed political consciousness coming into office, more so than anyone gave him credit for. Anyway, so March 30, he gives the speech, and it was kind of a routine, and it wasn't one of his best delivered speeches, but it was a good speech. And he leaves, walks to his car, the limousine, an armored 1972 Lincoln's 25 or 30 feet away from the entrance he walked into, and he's walking out. He's walking toward this car. 15 feet from him, at about the time he's about 10 feet from the car, is John W. Hinckley and a group of reporters, cameramen, just union guys who wanted to see Reagan. There he is, a gun in his pocket. You know, it's dark, cloudy day. It's 2:27 p.m. precisely when John Hinckley pulls out this gun, thinking that if he shoots the president, he's going to impress a movie star, Jodie Foster, who's at school in Yale. He's been stalking her, too. Pulls out the gun, unleashes six shots in 1.7 seconds. Six shots, that fast. The first one hits James Bray, the press secretary, in the head. He falls to the ground. The second one hits Tim McCarthy, and he falls to the ground. The third one goes high because the Jerry Parr, the agent in the trench coat, is already reacting. In 0.4 of a second, he had grabbed Reagan, not gently either, and thrust him towards that open limousine door, getting him in that door. The third shot goes high above their head. The fourth shot hits Tim McCarthy, as I said, swiveling, taking a bullet in the chest, and that agent is not wearing a bulletproof vest. Talk about guts. Takes him in the chest. The fifth shot hits the bulletproof window as they flash behind it. These doors open backwards. It's really interesting dynamic of the car, but the bullet hits that window as they flash behind it, and the sixth shot cracks across the driveway. At that moment, no one knows where that shot went. In reality, it struck the side of the car, slipped through a small gap between the door and the door frame, and struck Reagan in the left side as he's getting thrust in there. They land on the ground. Now, to rewind just a bit, Jerry Parr is already now saved, even though the president's been shot, Jerry Parr doesn't know this, he's already saved the president's life probably twice. One, he gets him out of Hinckley's direct line of fire, and Hinckley had like an effective shooting range about 20 to 30 feet at stationary targets. If Jerry Parr is a split second slower, and you follow the trajectory of the bullet where it hit him in the left side, it would have hit Reagan in the head. Presidency's over on the 70th day. On March 31st, 1901, we wake up, and George H.W. Bush is president. They're in the limousine. They pull away, and Jerry Parr looks out the window and sees three men down, a bullet mark in the left armored window, but Reagan seems okay. You know, he's checking him out. He runs his hands up and down through his hair, looking for blood, doesn't find anything. Reagan says he's okay. He's a little sore. He feels like maybe he got roughly shoved into the ground. His ribs hurt a little bit. And Jerry Parr gets on the radio and says, Rawhide is okay. Rawhide is okay. And Rawhide is Reagan's Secret Service code name. And there's probably no more apt code name for a president than Reagan on this day. And they're heading back to the White House. They're going back to the White House on Connecticut Avenue. I mean, like, so fast that the limo driver has his foot smashed on the accelerator. He barely misses a woman pushing a stroller across the street. They're taking off. They left the rest of the motorcade behind. I don't know if you've ever seen a presidential motorcade. They're really long. They're alone. There's been an assassination attempt. Jerry Parr doesn't know if the world's at war or if there's a decapitation strike or some terrorists are plotting stuff. You know, this is not too far in advance of when the Libyans, like, hired hitmen to go try to get the president. And so they're heading down to the White House. And about 30 seconds later, Reagan's not doing so good. He's having a hard time breathing. His face has turned ashen. he takes out a napkin and dabs it on his lips, and bright frothy blood is there. And Jerry Parr realizes Reagan's in severe distress, some real distress.
Dell, let's hold it right there. Okay. We got to hit a break right now. It's a great spot for a break. When we come back, we're going to hear what Agent Jerry Parr did next when he found blood coming out of Ronald Reagan's mouth on March 30th, 1981. We're with Dell Wilbur, author of Rawhide Down Again. Dell's going to have an event at the Denver Press Club this Thursday at noon. If you go to denverpressclub.org, you can get the details. You must RSVP to go to the event. Stay with us through these words here on Backbone Radio. We'll talk with Dell Wilbur a lot more right after this.
This is the home.